This episode of Forensic Forecast is brought to you by Digital Forensics Magazine at www.digitalforensicsmagazine.com and by contributions by our listeners. Thank you all very much. Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to Forensic Forecast. As always, I'm your host, Lee, and old faithful Eric Huber. How are you doing, Eric?
Hello, thanks for having me on again.
Always fun, always a pleasure. And today we're joined by a couple of new folk. We've got Doug Brush. How are you doing, Doug?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on, Lee.
Yep, no problem. You'll just let people know where you're from and what you do and stuff.
Yeah, my company is based out of New York. It's a digital forensic group. We work in digital forensics. We do a lot of civil litigation support. As it kind of tailors into e-discovery, we've also done some criminal work as well. And basically based out of the New York City area and for about the last two and a half years.
Cool stuff. And that means that we've got a hat-trick of East Coasters then, haven't we? Because we've also got, for the first time ever, a female on the show, and it is Cindy Murphy. How are you doing, Cindy?
I'm doing well, thank you. And actually, I'm in the Midwest, so not quite the hat-trick, but spoiler.
My apologies. I thought it was like Madison. Right on. I thought it was Madison, New Jersey.
That would be East Coast.
Yeah.
No, Madison, Wisconsin. I'm a detective here in Madison. I've been doing computer forensics for about 11 years and been a police officer for 25.
Wow, fantastic. All right. Well, got a few items you want to talk about this week. And to start off with, I just want to talk a little bit about the UK cybercrime challenge that's been going on. And this was covered in quite a few different news sources this last week or so, because it kicked off, and it didn't officially kick off. What happened is that they posted a small challenge on the website for people to get on with, and as it happens, there were some very smart people figured it out very, very quickly, and a lot of people were kind of left in the dust, not knowing what to do. So I found this quite interesting. Any of you guys see any of this at all?
You know, I read about it when you sent the story out, and I heard about it a little bit this week, and it's funny to really nurture my inner geek here and show how old I am. There was a movie back in the late 80s, called The Last Starfighter, or some kid. You saw that, okay, good, I don't feel so bad. It reminded me of that, or that the premise was, you know, these aliens send these arcade machines down to Earth, and it's this fighter pilot type game, and whoever wins, you know, this does really well at it, they abduct and they turn them into a pilot, this giant space battle. So it seems like somebody at the UK probably watched that and just converted that for cybersecurity recruitment.
I guess they found out there wasn't really a skills shortage. It's just there was a shortage of people to identify those who had the skills. So
yeah, I think these challenges are good. I mean, it is kind of an open casting call for the folks in our field that really don't know how to get themselves noticed. So these challenges are good. I'd like to see more US-based ones too as well.
Yeah, I think that it's based on the Department of Defense one. That it looks like they've worked in partnership with them somewhat in putting this all together. But there's going to be a few different aspects of this. It's going to be like the cybersecurity side, the digital forensic side, and I think there was another one which momentarily escapes my mind. But the forensics one, they haven't released that yet. That should be quite interesting when it comes out. But this, the one which they did put up, they put what they said was a cipher on the website, and people were urged to go and visit this and see if they could crack this code. And the register broke the news the next day that the cipher had already been figured out. And what it was is that on this on the website for this challenge, there was some what looked to be random hex all formed in a nice little pattern on there. And anybody who's done forensics for a while would have noticed straight away that it was a base 64 code for a JPEG. And so people were copying it, turning it into standard binary file, And they were like, that's it, job done. It's a picture of a, of an XKCD, like, comic strip. And people were like, I've done it. I've finished. When, you know...
Where's, like, the challenge? Yeah. Where's the challenge?
Yeah. And so all these geeks were like, yes, fantastic. I'm a genius because I've managed to figure this out. No. When you looked closer at the picture... when you looked at, you could look at the original picture online because it provided the web address within the picture itself as well. And there was a difference, is that there was a border in the new picture provided by the Cybercrime Challenge. And this border was black and white blocks all the way around the outside. And when you took a close look at this, this is actually binary. And it went, you know, it was white for zero, black for one, and it yeah. What you had to do is you had to go all the way around the border on this single pixel thing.
Wow.
And interpret into the binary. Then once you had the binary, that would give you a web address, which you had to go and visit. And the web address had a bunch of hexadecimal code on it, 1,000 character code, which you then had to interpret that. And it would tell you where to send this email, who to send it to and what to say in it in order to win the competition. So those people who said, yes, I've decoded the picture and thought they'd done the challenge, I'm very sorry, but you probably got about a tenth of the way there.
It's the digital quest.
You know that has to be a real geek came up with that challenge, don't you? Someone who... They thought, oh, this is going to be fun. I'm really going to have a go at this. What? Just stuff. The problem is, right, I mean, this is what occurred to me. What real-world ramifications does something like that have?
Yeah, I wonder if it's one of those situations where, you know, it's like you took, you know, in high school and you took math class. You were like, geez, what do I have to learn this? I'm like, well, it teaches you how to think. So I wonder if that was the idea behind this, which is, well, maybe it doesn't have a real practical application, but we want to see how people noodle their way to this problem.
Yep.
Yeah, it's trying to get you to get, you know, kind of get your eyes and ears open for things that you might not normally be looking for. Because, as you said, the first thing people are like, okay, I get it. And it's like, well, no, you have to kind of generally look a little deeper. It's never that easy.
And I guess there's another point in there about, you know, alternate uses of steganography and the fact that it can actually be plain view and have messages embedded in pictures. So it's, I think Eric's right. It's just teaching people to think and look deeper.
Yeah. No, I do agree with that wholeheartedly. I just hope that whenever they release the forensics challenge, for example, that they don't litter it with obscure items which in reality we don't ever really see in the field, even though they're theoretically possible.
That's sort of the joke about the certification tests. A lot of them is,
yeah,
that,
exactly,
some of those just doesn't occur in the real world, and some of the problems in the real world probably should be on the certification tests.
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember there was some pretty exotic stuff on some of the practicals I've done in the past. It's fun, but I've had, you know, a lot of things I haven't run into since.
I do think these kinds of things are funny. And I look forward to seeing what the other parts are to this. They haven't released them yet, but they've allowed people to sign up for their interest. Now, if you are in the UK, you are a UK resident, I believe. I don't think you have to be a citizen. I think you only have to be a resident. And you want to participate in this, then you can go to cybercrimechallenge.org.uk, I believe it is, and you sign up there, and in due course they will tell you where to go to get your information and get the disk images that you need for the forensics challenge and all that fun stuff. So if you're looking to get recognised, I know we talked last week about people who are looking to break into the field, then that's going to be a fantastic starting point to show, you know, if you do well in it, you can say, look, I won this competition, etc., etc. And, you know, off the back of that, then you could very well get hired.
The prizes on the on the challenge were pretty good too, with the internships and paid SANS courses, which is great.
Oh yeah, there's loads of sponsors on there, so they're all offering unique prizes of their own. So it's well worth entering. So yeah.
And you know, if they're working with the DoD folks, I think a lot of their challenges for the cybercrime challenge have been based on real world problems.
Yes.
that they've modified and put out there to the people to try to solve, and hopefully the success will be repeated if they keep using that pattern.
Yep. Now, speaking of the Department of Defense, an unfortunate story emerged this week, saying that there were a number of people, like several dozen people, who were employed by the U.S. Defense Department have been found to have been paying for child porn, or as we call them, indecent pictures of children over here, and essentially causing quite a lot of headaches for the government here. I don't know what you guys thought when you saw this story this week, but
I'm astounded. You kind of get that punch in the stomach feeling when you see these, and you're like, there's just so many questions of how they even had access to it, why it was not detected right away. And then the sad part is where they're seeing now that they just, you know, are dropping so many investigations that they just don't have the resources to follow up. So you really don't know how widespread this really could have been.
No. It's quite scary, because, I mean, they even say that some employees are suspected of having used their work computers to view the pornographic websites as well, which I think was quite bold by those people, obviously, but this is very, very bad on so many levels. And I think that the main worry here was that these people, if a third party had found out, rather than Department of Defense, this was going on, that there were avenues here for being able to turn people, and, you know, for them to get bribed or blackmailed into disclosing things which they wouldn't ordinarily do, just to protect their secret.
Well, and that's saying nothing about protecting the children and those people's lives. I mean,
well, exactly.
You know, in my experience, if people are looking at images of sex between kids and adults or child pornography, likely there's an interest there in that sort of thing in real life. And so, while there's the larger issue of whether or not it puts national security at risk, it certainly potentially puts somebody's personal security at risk, and I agree to see that they're dropping some of them due to a lack of resources. It really is troubling to me if they're finding that sort of problem in a government office. They ought to be going after it as hard as they can.
Absolutely. I think that one of the really worrying things about this is that the people who work in these offices, they're not just regular civilians either, are they? These are people who have got security clearance like no one else. And if they've been fully vetted and checked and stuff like that, and nothing's come up at all, then how many other people have slipped through the net who are interested in this kind of material in other organisations and other countries around the world? It is scary to think about that, really, I think.
Well, getting back to Cindy's point, you know, one of the things that I wonder about is, you know, how obsessed and taken over by this do you have to be compelled to do it? I don't know if it happened at work while on these organizations' networks. The article that I'm looking at, the CNN article, says some employees are suspected of using their work computers, so who knows, maybe they brought their laptop home and used their government laptop to access it. But I mean, how worked over do you have to be to use a government resource, especially when it's connected to you know, the two of the agencies they mentioned, one was, of course, the National Security Agency, which I think most people know about, and the other one is the National Reconnaissance Office. The National Reconnaissance Office is, you know, the stuff that they do is incredibly classified. They're the ones who do, they operate the, they even design and build the reconnaissance satellites for the intelligence community. So there's a lot of horrifying things that, that feed into this. One is, you know, geez, how bad are these people off? Getting back to Cindy's point, and two, it just amazes me. Even when people are surfing porn, you know, non-criminal porn at work. It's just, geez, you couldn't wait till you got home. I mean, it's that bad where you have to do it at work. So there's probably a psychology paper, you know, a thesis in here for somebody. But it's just amazing to read that.
I keep saying we need to come up with some sort of new discipline called computer forensic psychology, where we bring the psychologists and psychiatrists in to see what we're looking at and start developing profiles on personalities.
I think it's a great idea. I mean,
you can get a real feel for somebody's psychological makeup by running through their computer. And of course, while we're not qualified as forensic examiners to talk about that stuff, you do get a feel for who somebody is by looking at their file system.
Yeah, it's you know, we've talked about this before, Cindy. It's to get really geeky. It's I call it the Vulcan mind meld by proxy. I mean, if you look at if you get somebody's, and Cindy, I'm sure you get it more because as a police officer, you're probably dealing more with personal machines. But even, you know, with Doug and I, it sort of depends. We're having a machine that's used primarily for work, fine. But a lot of people use their work machines just like they use their personal machines. So, you know, you spend a while doing a forensic exam on somebody's laptop, you get to know them pretty well. In some ways, you get to know them pretty well than their friends and families do. So it can be a very emotionally draining experience. And, you know, Cindy, the work you do, especially with the child images, you know, the images of child sexual abuse, it's got to be just very mentally draining. I mean, it's bad enough, as it
absolutely
is.
And I guess I would put in a plug for a psychiatric technique called EMDR for people who are exposed to these images and movies a lot. It's a thing that I've been doing for several years to try to help myself cope over time with the sorts of issues that we get into. You know, it's a technique that a trained psychiatrist or psychologist can use to help take away some of the emotional impact of that stuff. And it really does work in my personal experience. So a little far afield from forensics, but I think the people who've been doing this for a long time know that it takes a bite out of your soul after a while, and coping techniques become pretty important.
Yeah, I've unfortunately experienced it in investigations, and it really sucks the wind out of your lungs the minute you see these types of things. And you do see the psychological buildup to it of how the, you know, particularly if you're looking at browsing activity and how, you know, you start creating a timeline, you can see how the momentum builds up to certain moments. And you really do start developing a psychological profile because you have to know what else they did. And, you know, my worry here too is what I've seen in the past too, is that a lot of these people or suspects when they do this, they tend to be collectors, and they bring in either, you know, if they're doing it at a work location, they'll bring in removable drives to offload the images and take it to the personal. So the question is now, you know, has this then now propagated out to other things where, you know, we're always trying to contain these images, make sure that it gets over to the right authorities, destroyed as it should be. But is their attitude now of saying, well, we don't have the resources, have they just basically allowed more of these images now to get out into the wild? And that's the real concerning part I have with it too.
I think though, because you brought that up before as well about them having dropped quite a lot of these investigations. Now, what Eric said before actually made me think about this, is that you've got National Security Agency computers, the National Reconnaissance Office computers, and you suspect that the users of those have been involved in child pornography. Who do you get to investigate those computers?
You would get... It most likely this was the Defense Criminal Investigative Service. I don't know that for a fact, but it's my guess, because the Department of Defense here in the U.S. has an Office of the Inspector General. They're really, really good. I've known some of the agents before. DCIS guys are just really good. And there's a lot of inspector generals here in the U.S. And some of these agencies are the biggest law enforcement agencies you've never heard of, and they have really good forensic capabilities. Department of Health and Human Service, the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration. They're the Inspector General's office that polices the IRS. So the really big, one of the really big inspector generals, of course, is the Defense Department. That's the Defense Criminal Investigative Service. So, and one of the things I've learned as a police officer, and I'm sure Cindy can attest to this also, is you take reporting on criminal matters in the media with a grain of salt, because I've had, you know, in my past life when I was a police officer involved in things, you know, I'd read the article, you know, maybe a couple days later, it's like, well, they spelled my name right, but they got nothing else right. So, you know, when I hear it's like, well, you know, they dropped it because of lack of resources, it's like, well, you know, who knows what happened.
Yeah. Right. And you know, if it's they may report on the drop in the bucket and get that one drop wrong, and it gets really frustrating. But I suppose from their point of view, they don't have a lot of police officers volunteering to just share information about ongoing cases. So it's hard to say where they're at with it, but hopefully, hopefully they'll follow through with those cases, get rid of the people who are causing the problems, and follow up appropriately.
It could be that drop for lack of resources was, you know, the original law enforcement agency says we don't have jurisdiction, or another agency came up, you know, maybe, you know, for example, hey, we figured out this guy was doing this with a work laptop. Gosh, he wasn't doing it on our network. Therefore, you know, we're handing this over to the FBI, you know, so who knows?
It is certainly...
I guess it points to how prolific this problem is around the world. I mean, it's huge. It's absolutely huge. And, you know, we've had employees at all levels of government, city, state, and federal government who've been caught with this stuff and caught at work. And I don't get it. I don't get it. And it's hard to see my tax money being spent on their salaries.
Yeah.
it's just one of those things, isn't it? Unfortunately, the people have deviations from normal behavior, and unfortunately, you know, where you can use the internet and technology for so much good in the world, you know, from our experience, you can see that obviously the opposite of that is true as well. And with the, you know, the speed of the internet and just the amount of data that's added to the world daily, it's just made getting hold of this stuff so much easier. And it is absolutely dreadful, but at the end of the day, I mean, that's what keeps a lot of people in this field employed. I mean, when I was at Zentec, and previously before that at Cypher, I don't know if you knew about this before, Cindy, but in the UK, we tender for police contracts over here. And so 95% of the work which I did before moving to my current company was probably investigating child abuse cases. So, like I say, I mean, it's just one of those aspects. It's one of the dark sides, well, probably the darkest side of computer use in the world, isn't it?
Yes, it sure is, and I'm happy for the other cases.
A bit of fraud, a bit of drug abuse, that's fine. Don't give me the child porn anymore. But I don't know if we'll hear anything more on that. I suspect we won't do. But it's certainly going to be an interesting one if we do.
I'm guessing we'll hear more.
It's a recruiting tool for me in the private sector, because, you know, after a while, police officers go, I don't want to look at this anymore. So, you know, I can tell them, well, you won't have to here, because in the private sector, it's, you know, you see images of child sexual abuse, which we do. And, you know, the process is, or it should be, you know, point, screen, call police. It's like, well, I don't have to look at the images. So,
So I'll just put in a plug one more time for EMDR, which is eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. It works really well for people who have to deal with this stuff all the time and have to keep coming back to it.
Cool stuff. All right. Well, Cindy, we're going to harass you some more now. Eric published on his blog a few days ago your paper about cell phones and their analysis and the like. Do you want to just give us a quick overview of that paper for us?
Sure, I'll just give you a little rundown of the history of it. I have been to several Mobile Forensics World conferences put on by Purdue down in Chicago over the last couple of years, I think three or four. And it seemed like every year I went, the first year I didn't speak, but I went and everybody complained about the lack of process. And the second year I went and presented and everybody complained about the lack of process. And so this last year, 2010 in May, I went and talked about the development of process for doing data extraction and examination of data from cell phones. And after that presentation, I had several people ask for the presentation in written form, saying, hey, if I just had that on paper, I could move forward with it and it'd be great. And so I picked away at it over the next several months. And when it got to a workable form, I sent it out to Eric Huber and Rick Mifflin and Gary Kessler and Sam Brothers and Mike Harrington and a group of other people in the cell phone forensics field, actually some overseas too. Pat Morrissey in Ireland, I sent it to him to take a look at and just ask them for input and comments and put those together. And as it always happens when you put something out to people, they read it and it got shared with some other people. And pretty soon people were calling and saying, can I use this? And in the meantime, I was sort of in talks with Digital Forensics Magazine, who wanted me to cut it in half and or split it across two quarterly issues. And so I had some conversations with some of the people I was having review the paper and basically said, look, you know, we've needed this. We've needed it for years, and since it had all sorts of good input from other people who provided parts of what I saw as a good process, I decided it was just probably as good to put it out in the wild and let people start to build on it and use it as the basis for a collaborative effort in the field. And so far the response has been really good. I've had some people say, you forgot SIM cloning, as a way to isolate phones. That's absolutely correct. I completely forgot it and none of my reviewers saw it. So it's been great because it's started the conversation, about instead of complaining about the lack of process, let's actually put some framework out there and start building it. It's really gotten a lot of interest and a lot of play, and it's spread all over the place. It's probably gotten more attention this way than it would have published through a single journal anywhere else. So I guess here's a toast to the bloggers of the world and getting the information out. It's worked really well.
Yeah, it was interesting because Cindy and I had a conversation this week that I sort of wanted to share with the group, which is it used to be kind of, you know, before blogs and the internet was used for a lot of publishing, that if you wanted to get information like this out, you were really limited to, you know, things like academic journals and you know, for pay magazines. So one of the reasons that you would go to a magazine or something like that was to get the information out. Now you have the option still to do that. You can go through academic journals, which people still do, especially in the academic community, because they're on the publish or perish program. So you want that as part of your resume. And it's nice to have an article published in a peer-reviewed journal because it's kind of a badge of accomplishment. And then you have kind of split the difference now. You have magazines like, digital magazines like Into the Boxes. That's Don Weber and Harlan Carvey. That's a real nice way to split the difference because it's electronic. It can be done relatively quickly. And then there's what Cindy did, which was she put it out basically to whoever wanted to publish it. So I had it, I put it on the blog, and I had a really big spike of traffic to the blog after that. I know Jesse Kornblum put the PDF version up on his blog. So Cindy was able to get the information out to the community very quickly through a variety of sources. And you kind of have to weigh that. You know, if you're a researcher and you've got something that you want to get out to the community, it's like, okay, if you go to a peer-reviewed journal, that's great. And I'm not saying that's wrong because I'm actually working on that process right now through a research project. But depending on their copyright, the way the rules work with that, you have to pick your journal rights because some of the journals I've seen, they pretty much take the copyright. I mean, you give it to them, like, thank you for sharing, and you can't distribute it. Whereas what Cindy did, you know, it's distributed all over the place. So it's interesting now. We can do research and spread it very quickly, just like what Cindy did.
My father, who's a really smart man, told me a couple of things early on. The first being that if you've got a really great idea, somebody else is having it too. And so if you're going to write about it, don't sit on it too long. Get it out there. And the other thing is that, here I am. I'm at a loss for words. Rarely happens. The other thing is that information should be free. Right? That if I need that information, if it's important in my work, that other people out there are going to be looking for the same sorts of things to help them do the job that they need to do. And at least right now, working in public service, I consider the ideas that I come up with and expand on, especially after they've been peer-reviewed by other people and people have said, yes, these are legitimate concepts and worth sharing. In my mind, I'm not here to make money off them. They should be there for us to move the field along, especially cell phone forensics, which really needs a boost right now. It needs people to be doing original research and thinking original thoughts and putting those on paper and getting them out there for others to review and test and comment on. And when you have to go with traditional resources like the journals, if there's a 6-month lag time in getting those ideas published after they've been reviewed, that gets to be a burden because information is passing a lot faster than that these days.
It really almost becomes now with the blogs like a kind of free and open source peer review for ideas and processes that you really kind of didn't have in the past with a lot of the journals and publishing. You can immediately get the feedback and put it back into the feedback loop and tailor it and make it so much more concise, much quicker than you ever have been in the past, where everybody can kind of put their input in and really, really make it a concise thing that everybody can agree on at some point. I mean, certainly you do have the ability to too much information, but it really allows it to continue to kind of move forward in ways that I don't think we've ever been able to.
Absolutely. That's one of the beauties of doing things like blogging and podcasting, though, isn't it? Is that you can get stuff out very, very quickly, and if it's something important, that's how you want to get it out. You don't want to have to wait for months on end for people to read this, for them to start changing the way they work. You want them to do it immediately. And
That's really true. And one of the things that I thought about this paper was that it's weird to me that nobody did it first before me, because for so long everybody had been talking about how much it was needed, and to me parts of it were already out there in the work that Gary Kessler's done, in the work that Sam Brothers has done, in the work that Rick Ayers has done, and it just really needed somebody to take all of those concepts and put them into a framework, and I was really surprised that nobody had done it yet.
Yeah, this is some paper as well, because this thing, this article is absolutely immense. It's huge. How long did it take you to collate all the information and put it together?
Oh, actually, not so long. But remember, I'm a city cop in a city of 250,000 people, and so I'm doing police reports every day. Writing isn't a challenge for me all that much. And I had the PowerPoint, which was a really nice outline to work with. So, you know, pulling that stuff together wasn't so hard because the presentation had already been done, and then writing it up was actually fairly easy because I already had the outline from the PowerPoint. So really it was little pieces of work over quite a bit of time. So not so hard.
Okay. But now some people will say, well, why would you do that then? Why would you invest? Even though you say it didn't take very long, just the sheer length of the article and all the thought processes in it, I suspect it's probably taken collectively, you know, probably a day's worth of putting everything together at least. Why do that and release it for nothing?
Oh, it's what? Not for nothing. It's not for nothing. It's because it's so needed out there. We as forensic examiners are going to have to deal with phones from now until some other technology replaces that for communication. And in computer forensics, and you'll see a lot of the process is borrowed from computer forensics, we have a process that we follow, and the process may vary depending on where you work, but in general, the parts of it are going to be pretty familiar. And cell phone forensics really needed that because we have all of these tools, all these operating systems, all these different devices. And at some point in time, somebody's going to be saying, well, did you do it right? And if the answer is there is no right way, there is no process, it's just random. I don't think that's acceptable for juries or for us. I mean, there should be some framework, some process to make it science rather than throwing a random tool at a problem. And so what this is an attempt to bring the science back into the extraction of evidence from these devices so that it brings it closer to what we're already doing in computer forensics. And it's interesting to me that, you know, a lot of the vendors out there have made attempts in this direction, both with the collection of phones and with processing them, but it's always been very tool oriented and very vendor specific. And you know, the people who are using the tools, cops are good at process. We follow process for everything, and it was needed. So I don't think it's for nothing. It's to contribute is why it is. We should all be contributing, especially in this field where there's so much to be learned and so much to be done yet. One great thing about cell phone forensics is that we don't know, well, in forensics all over the place, we don't know everything there is to know. We can't know everything there is to know. And so if we can all contribute a little bit in our own way, we move everybody forward.
Absolutely. I would give a big amen to the contribution of that as well. I think that this is a theory of mine, is that, you know, most of the people in this field are smart people who do work and they know things or they learn things along the way that if they shared it more, it would benefit the field so much as a whole. But for whatever reason, because they don't want to, they don't want to spend the time doing it, or they feel as if, you know, why would anybody care about what I'm talking about here? That they don't do it. And that's why I think that it's important that you got people like Harlan and like Eric and like yourself who go out and actually you know, put themselves on the line and say, this is what we have. If anybody wants to then come back and say, well, yeah, we can let's take this and build off it, then they're free to do so. But whether regardless of what side you work on in this field, everybody's in the same pot. Nobody, like you said, nobody knows everything. But collaboratively, that I can guarantee there's not a lot that people that we don't know as a whole. That if we shared the information appropriately, that you know it would increase our collective knowledge and everything to such an extent. I just it needs to be done more.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely those moments, you know, particularly if you go to like Forensic Forecast, Digital Detective, Twitter, where you're just banging your head against the wall on a problem, and then somebody says, "Oh wait, no, just do this," and you're through it, and it's like. That, it's that collective mindset, that kind of mind meld of everybody being able to be better as a sum of the parts. So it's really, there should be more push for the collaborative and sharing aspect of the field.
One of the things which, one of the presentations at the SANS Summit was done by Chris Harms from Mandiant. And this presentation, basically they were releasing a piece of software, like an information sharing piece of software that basically would talk about various different exploits and various different vulnerabilities of a system and how to find, you know, if a system had been hacked a certain way, and you could log all that information for other people to use somewhere down the line. And me and Mark McKinnon just kind of looked at each other and just said, well, how difficult would it be to do something like this for digital forensics? And the answer is not very. It'd be fairly straightforward to do, but are enough people willing to put themselves on the line and say, this is it.
Really, I think as we mature in the field, putting yourself on the line is what it's all about. If you're confident in your fundamental training, in your background, in your experience, you should be secure enough to accept the criticism and to answer the questions that arise. Because if you're not doing that, you're not truly testing yourself as a forensic examiner. So I think it's an important part of this field in general. And you mentioned Mark McKinnon. You talk about a guy who's willing to collaborate and share. He's fantastic in that area. And, you know, we do need more people who are willing to share whatever skills they have. I'm not a skilled programmer, but boy, he is, and he's fast. and if you have a problem, he's willing to help you work on it. And you know, when you collaborate, you find those people in this field who are willing to help you move your own work forward, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah. And one of the things that there's one of the barriers I've noticed when I talk to IT people and digital forensics people is they get caught in the trap, and I know I certainly did, and this is the reason why I didn't contribute for a long time, is because I don't know everything, I don't know anything. And that's something you have to get over. And, you know, I look up to people like Harlan Carvey and Rob Lee and Jesse Kornblum. And I understand that these guys have more kung fu than I will ever have. All right. Because if you look at their educational background, like Harlan went to VMI. He's got a degree in electrical engineering. Jesse went to he's got two MIT degrees in electrical engineering. And I think Rob is electrical engineering also. I mean, these guys went to really good schools, had really good fundamental technical skills, and the really sharp people who decided to make digital forensic their careers, and they flourished because they're very smart people, they're very curious, and they're very productive. I don't have that background. I got a bachelor's degree in law enforcement and a master's degree in public administration. Believe me, there's no coding skills involved with any of that. So a lot of it is what I've learned along the way through training and just being curious. So And so I picked, you know, the first thing I did was the Adobe Flash cookie research, where I picked something and I actually partnered up with somebody, my research partner, Christian Gudgeonson, who was an electrical engineer and went to a bunch of good schools. And that's helped the project move along. And there's other stuff I know I can do on my own and I can get some help. And I've talked to people, I'm not going to name him, but there's one person I've been pushing to do some research because he's a really sharp fellow. And you know who I'm talking to because you're listening to the podcast. I know. Really sharp guy, and you know, and he falls into this kind of this trap I do, which is, well, gosh, I don't know what I'm going to research. It's like, I talked to him the other day. It's like, okay, pick this, you know, particular artifact, you know, and read up on it, and you don't have to do the original art, the original research on it, but you can learn through all the little bits and pieces that everyone else has out there. Put those little bits and pieces together into a strong presentation, and you'll be definitely be contributing something. You don't necessarily have to be doing cutting edge research and tool development to contribute to the field. There's a lot of just diffuse information out there that you can put together. And like, for example, the next project I'd like to do is I'd like to do memory forensics for non-incident responders. There's a lot of information on memory forensics for folks who do incident response, but I'd like to be able to show people how, you know, people like Cindy and myself, who do maybe do corporate law enforcement stuff, if you're not doing the hacking forensics for memory, you can do things like pulling out chat logs and web history and all this stuff. Well, I'm not going to be doing any original tool development. I don't think I'm going to be doing any real original research, but what I'll be doing is picking up the bits and pieces that everyone else has put together out there and hopefully putting it into, you know, one big paper and presentation where I can just get the word out to people. So you don't have to do cutting edge original research. And just because you're not as smart as Rob Lee and you don't have the background there, doesn't mean you shouldn't be doing this.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. And this sort of pulls into one other pet peeve of mine. And that is that, that we still talk about computer forensics training rather than an education in computer forensics. And you never get trained to the point where you're done being in this field. It's impossible. So I think people need to start thinking about it as what it really is, and that is a lifetime learning experience where you're always looking for the next set of education that fits into the picture. And a second pet peeve, and that is, and Harlan Carville backed me up on this, it's when people think that they don't know enough to even have the conversation with you. you know, you get to a point, the people who are our heroes, Jesse Kornblum and Harlan Carvey and Rob Lee, they're still people, and they still are interested in this stuff and are willing to talk to anybody about it. And so, I've just started picking up the phone and calling people because they truly do love talking about the stuff.
Yeah, it's not just that, though, is it? It's that there's more to it than that, because even the people who we look up to, who we think, you know, these guys are like the computer forensic gods, you know, they freely admit they don't know anything. And they even, if you come up with something good, they come to you and ask for your advice on it as well. These guys realize they don't know everything as well, and they're happy to learn about new concepts and things like that.
That's because the really smart people know they don't know anything.
Yeah, there you go.
I was at the Hope conference a couple of weeks ago, and one of the presenters was basically saying that. He said, "Listen, I'm not an expert in anything. Like, I have a real curiosity. I've been doing InfoSec for a long time." But he's like, as soon as you try to pitch in your hole into that area, say, "Well, okay, I've made it. You know, I'm done now. I'm an expert." It's not the right field for you, because it never ends. Every day there's something new in this field, so you have to constantly have that hunger to want to tinker and toy and figure something out, or it's just never ending.
And to kind of talk about Lead It, when I first did the Adobe Flash cookie research, I released a very early version of the paper for a brief amount of time, just hoping to get some input on it to help me keep going. This is even before I hooked up with Kristen on this. And it went well. I got some good feedback. And then one day on my email, I got an email from Jesse Kornblum saying, "Hey, can I have a copy of the paper?" And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God. You know, good news, bad news. It's like, all right, the good news, Jesse Kornblum wants the paper. The bad news is Jesse Kornblum wants the paper. So I'm, like, expecting, you know, a couple days later to go to his blog and see, you know, Eric Huber's useless. Here's all the things that I found, you know, awful on this. I'm like, oh, man. So I sent it off. And, you know, and even as I look at the paper now, it actually was fairly decent. I made some mistakes on it. He was very encouraging. He looked it over. He's like, oh, this is great stuff. You know, keep going with it. Like, wow. So for me, that was a big push where, okay, worst case scenario, at least people aren't going to throw things at me. So I'll just keep going on and see how it goes. And what I found is a lot of the gurus, if you approach them respectfully and you're not a pest, they will, they're happy to help.
Yep. Absolutely. Okay. So just moving on from that, we talked about Mark McKinnon ever so briefly. Now, unfortunately, Mark's in one of these states over in Michigan where without a PI license, his hands are pretty tied, and he gets to do small amounts of digital forensics work, but not as much as he'd like to. This is the case in several states, as we've loved to talk about before, and I promised Luby that I would keep this as brief as possible, because he hates talking about PI license laws. The state of Illinois has released a statement. It released this on July 12th, effectively saying that the definition of private detective now includes computer forensic investigations, and anybody who was engaged in computer forensics, be it individual or company, at the time that the PI law came into practice, or came into force, rather, they're now grandfathered in. Effectively, and they can continue doing digital forensics without the requirement of a PI license. So, fantastic news there. And I hope that this kind of thing spreads quickly around the other states, really.
Yeah, I have to say that the way that the letter was composed was actually pretty thoughtful and even-handed in its approach by saying, you know, hey, listen, there's been investigators around for years. The technology and the digital aspect of it kind of caught everybody off guard, so we had to make adoptions. But upon further review, this is what we think is necessary so people can continue to do their work now. And I would hope it would fall on the desks of other states that, you know, hold their cards so close to their chests and won't allow it. I mean, I'm fortunate enough, in New York State, not to have to worry about it, but the firm that I work with, my partner, is a PI. But even when we get asked to do work in either, you know, South Carolina or Texas, we have to go through all these regulations, filling out extra paperwork, and it's cumbersome to get the job done, and it hasn't really seen it solve a purpose yet.
And this letter is a good letter, but there's sort of a cautionary tale in this, in that people should understand, and most of us in computer forensics probably do because we have an understanding how the law works, but you know, there's criminal law, there's civil law, and then there's this very powerful aspect of the law, at least here in the United States, and I'm sure it's probably the same in Europe and the UK, called administrative law. And effectively, that's where a state legislature or a federal legislature delegates essentially legislative authority, they call it rulemaking authority, to the executive branch. And that's what we see in this letter, where this is the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation. Basically what they say in the letter is like, okay, fine, the question has been posed to us, is computer forensics covered under this PI law? And they say in the letter, it's like, it could be interpreted to include computer forensics investigations, but they go on to say why they don't think it's a particularly good idea, so they're going to decline to do so. And what they said is, in fact, they say specifically in the letter, when the act was written, computer forensics was not contemplated. Technology simply moved ahead of the statutory language. And essentially what this regulatory agency is saying is the technology has moved ahead of the law. The law hasn't kept up to it. But what they say in the letter is, the phrase used, until such time as a legislator can consider and pass amendatory language to the act. In other words, what they're telling people is the legislator could change the definition to cover computer forensics. And in the last sentence of the letter, it says the department reserves the right to reconsider. So yeah. Depending on, you could have an administrative change, either a new governor or even a new secretary of whatever this department is, they could next week decide, you know what, we've had new information, we've decided to change it, and that's all over. So that's why it's important for this to be addressed in the state houses, where legislation can be crafted, because it's great that an administrative agency has made this decision this time, but it easily could have gone the other way, and it easily could go the other way in the future.
It still leaves things quite up in the air. It still leaves things quite up in the air, doesn't it?
You read the last paragraph, and really, as Eric just said, it seems good for now, but at any moment they can say, as another state, or the lobbying body of the people that want to see this changed can push for it and make the change. So hopefully there will be some continued thought and care given to the actual need and understanding of how the process of computer forensics works, as opposed to the private investigator's license. So hopefully they'll keep up with it, but it's not set in stone by any means.
No, I mean, just,
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I just think that a lot of these laws are being enacted without any consideration for the jurisdictional complications that they inherently cause, and it just isn't a real good example of why we need some sort of overreaching educational body to inform on this issue, and so the efforts to bring CDFS to the front I think are a good idea. Hopefully eventually we'll get everybody on the same page. It's us in the U.S. with all of our states going different directions again. It's par for the course, I guess.
Yep. Yeah. All right, so CDFS was going to be the next thing I was going to say anyway, and I think that people really need to get behind this, not just people who work doing private work or defense work, because that is only because what we'll end up with is we'll end up with an anti-HTCIA. I think what we all need to do is get together, regardless whether you're law enforcement, whether you work defense or corporate, because eventually this kind of thing could affect everybody. And it deserves our support, this kind of thing, I think. And congratulations and props to Rob Lee for being involved in something else which is potentially going to revolutionize the field, especially in the United States. So,
yeah, which again amazes me against about Rob Lee is when did this man ever have time to sleep? It's beyond me. But yeah, for him to push this and try to get the organization together on this and get the community behind it, because I think, Lee, you certainly said in the past, is that, either as a community we can make this decision ourselves and push our own standards, or wait around till somebody else does it. And it's probably not going to be the way we want it if somebody else does it.
Yeah.
Well, just for full disclosure purposes, you've got two other CDFS board members on the call.
This is true, yeah.
Involved. But it really is, we're doing our best to lay the framework ahead of time to involve not only people from all sectors who are involved in forensics, but also people from all over the world. And we're hoping that we'll come up with a board in the end that represents worldwide interest in forensics, because we know that that's where the jurisdictional boundaries are. It's no longer a local issue, a state issue, a national issue. It's worldwide. And we have to come together as a profession in order to address the issues that arise across the world.
It did completely escape my mind that you were part of CDF.
Yeah, as
well.
I'm looking at the
I can only apologize for that. I knew that and I forgot.
All right. We'll let Rob be the public face. We like that.
All right, cool stuff. Now, just going back to something which we talked about last week, we're talking a little bit about how people in the field who are new in the field, maybe who've just got their degrees or somebody who's looking for a career change, can get the foot in the door with some of these forensic companies. And Eric, you and Andrew, you both said that a good thing to do was go out and perhaps do an investigation of sorts and come back and show that, you know, a report and how you've gone about doing this and all kinds of stuff. And almost as if this man listens to the podcast, an article appeared on the Sans Forensic blog by Ken Pryor saying, "I'm here, now what?" And in this article, he's done a fantastic job of going through, scouring the internet for superb resources where you can get disk images, or there's certain challenges available for people who want to get into digital forensics or are in digital forensics. And he's just put them all in a superb blog post, which if you want to do something like this, if you want to make a good impression when you go for an interview or anything else, this would be a great place to start. And thank you very much, Ken, for putting this together.
Yeah, it's a really great – I learned some sources for information that I didn't know about before that I'll be able to use just for – not only if you're hoping to get into the field, but those of us who are already in the field, you know, sometimes I want test images to try, you know, something else on. And, you know, there's only so many times – and I think Ken has said this before – and there's only so many times you can examine your own computer before it gets boring. So there's actually some additional sources in there that I found. And as a follow-up to last week, because I feel a little bad about this, I talked to somebody about the last podcast. I had somebody call and take me to task saying, "Hey, great podcast, guys, but you know, you got it wrong on the job market because you forgot a certain aspect of the field, and that's the intelligence and the government area." And I'm not going to say who talked to me, but his name rhymes with Lobbery. And he said, you know, that's great for, you know, maybe you guys are right for corporate and law enforcement, which, you know, was the background that we had. But one of the things that he said is, look, there's a lot of hiring going on in D.C. right now. So if you're, you know, a new person in the forensic field, you're new to the field, you know, you can have some really good job opportunities down there. And he didn't tell me to say this, but, you know, the folks that you'd want to talk to, let's say, you know, you're getting ready. You got your bachelor's degree, your master's degree, you know, you're raring to go. You know, talk to the Mantecs and the Mandiants and the CSCs and the folks who are hiring people to send people to the various agencies and the contracts in the D.C. area. And I'm sure there's other areas, too, or the government, because what I'm being told is, you know, the hiring there is still pretty robust. So if you're willing to work in that field, and I would encourage people to do that because it's really interesting stuff, that's a very good option. In fact, I had, as an example, I got contacted by an experienced law enforcement officer not that long ago saying, look, you know, I've only got X amount of time left before they're going to push me out the door because of their, you know, the way it works for retirement. And I want to get in the private sector, and I haven't had, you know, I'm not having any luck. So I said, well, you know, if you're interested, and this person didn't want to do the typical, you know, the consulting thing, or it's, you know, essentially the prostitution consulting thing where they're sending you out all over the place and some strange man sends you to a hotel room to do things you don't want to do and keeps most of the money, which is either prostitution in my past life or consulting in my current life. I said, you know, maybe you want to look at the DC market because, yeah, it's consulting, but you're going to be in a particular contract. You won't have to move around. And sure enough, I didn't hear anything from him. And I got a nice email from this person a couple weeks later saying, yeah, I talked to, you know what, I took your advice. I talked to agency X and they hired me and I'm going to go to work for government agency Y. So I'm like, great. You know, so this is a further proof that, you know, that government market is there. So for those of you crying in your beer because you can't get hired by local law enforcement or, you know, the corporate thing slowing down, you've got some really good alternatives if you're willing to take a move.
I think you've only got to look at the people who are in or around the DC area to see exactly how much of a hub it is for digital forensics.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you've got the guys from that other podcast who were, yep. Who were over there. Brett and Ovi are both based over there, and you know, Rob Lee, and not a million miles away, you've got Harlan Carvey. You've also got Jesse Kornblum around there, and all those people, that they're there for a reason. And it, you know,
it's no accident that they're all kind of centraled around the DC area.
No, absolutely not. And that's it did appear to me that when I was over there a couple of weeks ago, that was definitely the case. If you were in the position to move, to find work in this field, then that area is the place to go without question. So, yeah. So it's not all doom and gloom.
To the East Coast now. I can just see all the forensic people packing up their bags and heading that direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, now we're going to get Rob back on our tail again this week just to say, whoa, hang on.
Just to tie up on that thought, though, you know, going back to Ken's post, but that is, you know, another thing is, too, it's people complain that they're slow or there's don't stop, you know, testing new tools or getting out there and downloading disk images. You know, you kind of got to slow times. There can be opportunities to kind of maybe work on that one area you're feeling a little weak on is to, you know, go to one of the sites that are listed, you know, with the NIST images and just take some time to really get more granular on things that you might not know. And the only other one I would really add that might not have been on Ken's post was forensickkb.com with Lance Mueller stuff. He has some really good stuff that you could, and it walks you through, and it's, you know, another great resource that you can use.
Yeah, I've had Lance on the show before, and absolutely, he was actually the one who set up all the test images that Guidance still use, even though he's not worked there for several years now. So he knows what he's doing. Just on a side note of that, there was a few people who have been in touch with me asking what they can do, or where they can get these things. And I thought, well, maybe I might end up putting some of these test images together myself and hosting on the Forensic Forecast site. Now, this isn't going to be something which is going to happen overnight, because I want to make sure these things are done properly. So over the space of maybe the next 2 or 3 months, maybe I'll start putting a couple of these things online. And rest assured, everything will not be as it first appears. So,
will there be binary around the black and white border?
Yeah. Well,
you have to, yeah. The photograph of the computer has a border in binary. Yeah, so I'm gonna have a go at that as well. And if other people, if anyone wants to do stuff like that, like we said before, just go ahead and do it. Because you can only be helping people in the long run, so please do. But, yeah, we've run out of the stories that I wanted to talk about. Has anybody else got anything to bring up? Any interesting tidbits? Or wow.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I've started doing here, and I'm just throwing this out to the, to the audience to consider, is I actually created, and I don't have a lot of time for this, but I actually created a Wikipedia account so I could take a look at and edit, you know, some of the computer forensics account or the computer forensics articles. In fact, the one on computer forensics, I did some tweaking this week. So I would encourage those of us in the community, because it occurs to me, people, like it or not, people use Wikipedia as a primary reference source. So when people are researching computer forensics and all this other stuff, a lot of the first places they're going to show up are these Wikipedia articles. So if we want our people learning about the community to get good information and have a good, you know, positive experience or a good idea of what we do, a lot of these people are going through the Wikipedia stuff. So I started to at least do some editing around the edges. Like I said, I don't have a lot of time for it, but it occurs to me, if a lot of us, or at least a handful of us, get involved in this, we could actually improve the face of the community through the world, at least as it goes through the Wikipedia filter.
Absolutely. Just as you were saying that, I typed in volume shadow copy on Wikipedia, disappointed to see that I haven't been mentioned anywhere. So,
Oh, that, we know what your evening is like.
No, I'm just kidding. All right. Cool stuff. Well, I'd like to say thank you to all three of you who have been kind enough to join us again today. As always, Eric, thank you very much for being a part of Forecast.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you.
I don't think we could possibly do it without you now, to be honest.
I think you could, but I appreciate that you don't.
And Cindy, it's been a pleasure having you on here this week. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And hopefully we'll get you back again sometime as well.
Absolutely.
And Doug, very, very kind of you to join us as well this week. Thank you for being on.
Well, certainly thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, nice to actually talk to you in person rather than just on Twitter for once.
Exactly.
All right, cool. Well, if you're interested in being on Forensic Forecast, then drop me a line. Be glad to see what we can do with that. In the meantime, you can follow Forensic Forecast on Twitter at Forecast. We've also got the Facebook group, the LinkedIn page, and, you know, just Google us. We're everywhere. But, yeah, thank you very much for joining us, and we'll catch you again next time. Bye for now. After we finished recording this week, it was suggested to me that we do a live episode of Forensic Forecast. So the next episode, we're going to aim to try and do this. Now, it's going to take a little bit of work, but I think it's possible. But I really need everybody's support for this. If you're interested in listening, please listen live to the show, because if I don't get a lot of input and if a lot of people don't turn up to listen, then it'd be very difficult for me to justify going through the same effort again in the future. So yeah, please support us, and that'd be a great help. Thank you very much.